We come today to the whole issue of how do we train lay people and what are some of the techniques that we use in all of this. Now, this morning I'd like to take a different perspective than what we have done before, and I hope we'll find this interesting and helpful. But to give you a perspective on where I'm going, I've broken this down into three parts. This is a very sophisticated sounding outline. I'm going to talk about two scripture passages. I'm going to draw two diagrams on the board, and then give you two grocery lists. You know what a grocery list is? You take it in and you've got all the things you're going to buy in the grocery store. Well, these are grocery lists on how to listen and how to respond and what to do in counseling. And if we can look at these things this morning, I think we'll get a remind ourselves of some of the basics. Now, here is one place in the conference where I have a little bit of mixed feeling, because I know that some of you are old hands at this and may find this elementary, but it's a good reminder. Others of you are getting started in your counseling experiences, and I hope this will be helpful in terms of practical counseling techniques. I could have spent time, I suppose, talking about how lay counselors are trained and some of the technical aspects of that, but I don't think that's necessary, because I think much of this is being done here in Queensland. You are, in many respects, ahead of where I am and where some of my colleagues are in this kind of process. And I thought it might be more helpful if we focused our attention on some of the techniques that can be used and some of the methodology that we may follow. So I'd like to begin. First, I'm going to begin with a passage of Scripture that I have written about. And so I'll pass over this relatively quickly. We'll start with the New Testament. Then we'll go to the Old Testament. So if you've just brought a New Testament with you this morning, you've got a problem. Didn't bring any Bible at all, you've got a double problem. But we are compassionate, caring, sensitive, loving individuals, and we will still accept you, won't we, with empathy, warmth, and genuineness, right? Maybe. Let's begin by looking at Galatians chapter 6. I mentioned this yesterday, and I want to mention it again this morning, because I think it is so crucial in any aspect of counseling. I may have mentioned this in the People Hub, a book I was going to check, and I forgot to check. But I keep reminding myself about this, because I would suggest to you that if we are going to be effective counselors, we have to start not with counseling techniques, not with counseling theories, not with counseling methodology. We have to start with the person who is doing the people helping. And the person who is doing the people helping, that's you and me. I mentioned in one of my talks, I think last night, that there had been some research in which they compared people who were effective counselors with those who were not. And they discovered that it didn't really matter a lot how old you were. Older people are not necessarily better than younger people. If you are a younger person, let no man despise thy youth. Some of you can be very, very effective in people helping. That age didn't seem to make a difference. Sex doesn't seem to make a difference in terms of counseling. Women are not necessarily better or worse than men. Please don't forget that. We have more women coming into this field professionally right now, incidentally, than we have men, at least at home. Experience may make some difference, but certainly there doesn't seem to be any difference in terms of what denomination one goes to, whether or not one attends church, where one went to university, or whether one went to university. The research that has been done, most of it, the initial research done in Canada, said that the people who are good counselors have different personality characteristics from the people who are poor counselors. I came across this research probably 20 years ago, not quite that long, when I was in Switzerland spending a year trying to write a book about a man named Paul Tournier, T-O-U-R-N-I-E-R. Paul Tournier was a delightful man who had no formal training in counseling. He's often referred to on the back of his books as a well-known Christian psychiatrist. He was not. In fact, somebody said to Paul Tournier one day, he asked a person, should I go back to medical school? He was a physician. Should I go back to the university and get a degree in psychiatry? And one of his psychiatric friends said, no, Paul, don't do that, because you have such a compassion and such a concern and such a love for people. We're afraid if you go back to school and study psychiatry, you'll lose some of that. And incidentally, there is research evidence to show that that happens. Sometimes you take people who are very effective people helpers, and then they go on into a master's or a doctoral program or into a psychiatric residency, and when they come out, they're less effective than when they went in. Part of the reason being, they're so concerned about technique, they're so concerned about theory, they're so concerned about being professional, that they've forgotten the people that they're trying to work with. When that research came out about 10 years ago, I shared it with some of my students, and I said, guess what?
guys and gals. You're spending several thousand dollars to come here, and when you go out, you'll have a master's degree, but you'll be a worse counselor than when you came in. Now, in terms of knowing the technical aspects, however, that training can be helpful. I don't want to put it down. In terms of knowing how to deal with more difficult problems, that training can be very useful. But many times, how we counsel depends on the kinds of people we are. And I suggest to you that many of the characteristics of counseling are characteristics that can be developed. And certainly, what they found in that research about warmth and empathy and genuineness, as I mentioned last night, that can be developed. But as I read the research and looked at Paul Tournier, who had a counselor personality, I don't know how else to describe it, I was reading one day in Galatians, and I came to Galatians chapter 6. And this marvelous little passage, I read it frequently as a reminder to myself, and might be a good reminder to you. It starts out, brothers. The first talk I gave in Australia, I got in trouble for how I quoted the scripture. Some lady came up to me and she said, "You're using the wrong text. You've got a sexist text." And some of the new interpretations of scripture would not say brothers. They would say fellow Christians or something like this. Well, some of the people responded like you did, but anyhow, I got over that. So in any case, if Paul was writing today, he wouldn't say brothers. He wouldn't say sisters. He would say persons, right? Or fellow people or something like that. We can't even have male men at home. We have to have, you can't even have male persons at home because that's male. So you have to have postage persons or something like that. But in any case, I do have a sensitivity, though, for people who are concerned that sometimes there is a put-down of women. And I've picked up some of this in this society, like I pick it up in my own. And I think it's sad that that happens. That's some of the kinds of discrimination that we could be talking about tonight. And women are very often better counselors than men. I think it's true in our family, incidentally, where my wife, I think, in many respects, is more sensitive as a counselor than I am. And I applaud that. I think the Lord has given her some gifts that I don't have, just as He's given me some gifts that she doesn't have. And that, I think, is great. Well, He's writing to fellow believers, brothers or sisters. If someone is caught in a sin, you who are spiritual should restore such a one. Now, the good people helper is somebody who is spiritual. Let us never forget this. And if you're concerned about training people, let me suggest that that's the place to start. Think of the wheel we presented yesterday morning. You start with that biblical spiritual in the center. If you are involved in any kind of a program, maybe you're involved in an educational program, maybe you are a student, and you want to be an effective people helper, begin, I suggest, by working on your spiritual life. What does that mean? You who are spiritual? Well, my Bible, and probably yours, has part of chapter 5 on the same page that we're on right now. And you'll remember that in chapter 5, we read about the fruit of the Spirit, verse 22 of chapter 5. It's love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Now, if you had to go to a counselor, what kind of a counselor would you want to go to? That's the kind of counselor that I would want to go to. Somebody who is patient with me, somebody who is characterized by love, somebody who had a sense of kindness, somebody who had an inner peace, somebody who was basically good and faithful, and somebody who was gentle, somebody who was at least in some control of their own lives. And this is the kind of people that I believe God wants to be people helpers. If you want to be a people helper or to train other people, begin with the spiritual. You who are spiritual, restore such a one. That restore, incidentally, is a word used to bring, they would tear their, the nets would get torn when they go out fishing, and the fishermen would get back and they'd sew the nets together and bring them back to wholeness. So the implication here is, you who are spiritual, you bring the person back into wholeness. And notice, you should restore him gently. I think the second characteristic of people helpers is that they are gentle. Now, one of the questions that came in, and a very good question, asks about Dr. Adams' more confrontational approach. There's a place for that. But I suggest that you're going to get further with people if you are gentle with people. Think about that in your own life. Think about that with your own families, with your own kids, maybe in your own growing up, maybe in teachers who have, in a sense, challenged you in some way. When they have done it gently, you probably have been more likely to respond when they have sort of hit you and confronted you, especially if the confrontation has been insensitive. And let me remind you that gentleness is one of the fruits of the Spirit that we just talked about. So the good people helper is first spiritual. The good people helper, secondly, tries to be gentle.
You may not be a gentle person, and yet if gentleness is one of the fruit of the Spirit, then as the Holy Spirit works through your life, you develop that gentleness. It takes time, but it comes. Thirdly, the good people helper is alert. Watch yourself, or you may also be tempted. Here this apostle is writing to people who fall into some kind of difficulty, and you go by to try and restore them. But be careful, or you too may be tempted. We know that when we get with people in any kind of a people-helping situation, they start talking about their problems. And many times, that can be, if we're not careful, we can get carried along by their problems. Remember my friend last night who was a psychiatrist who talked to that nice lady who came to see him about the problems he had, and eventually his marriage broke up because of this. It is very easy when we're involved with people who are in a people-helping situation, it's easy to let our curiosity take over. See, I, for example, would never ask anybody in this room, tell me about your financial situation. I'd like to know how much money you make and how you're doing. That's not the kind of thing that I ask. You don't talk about those things in social conversation. But if you came to me and said, I'm having a terrible time making ends meet, and it seems to me that our financial struggles are the major difficulty we're having in our marriage, then it would be quite appropriate to say, tell me about your finances and how you're handling them, and let's see if we can work on that. I would never ask anybody, well, tell me about your sex life. I'm very much interested in how Christians in Australia, how they express themselves sexually. That would be very interesting for me. Well, I'm sure it would be interesting for everybody here, in a way. But that's not the kind of thing that the committee invited me to do. At least I didn't see any place on the brochure. That's not the kind of thing you talk about, obviously, in polite conversation, unless you know somebody very, very well. But if they are having difficulties in this area, then it is appropriate to raise some questions. But be very careful that you don't keep pushing and asking questions that are not going to help you understand the person, but are going to satisfy your own curiosity. Or are going to give in to your own temptation. You've got to be careful here. And I suggest to you that people helping can be a dangerous thing. Somebody was telling me last night about getting involved in people helping as a lay person and said the first thing I learned was the dangers that are involved in people helping. Some of you who are involved in doing a lot of this, you know the dangers. You know how easy it is to get manipulated. You know how easy it is for you to get aroused in ways that are not healthy. You know how easy it is for you to find your own spiritual life beginning to slip as you are dealing with the pain and sometimes, if I can use this term, the garbage that seems to have characterized other people's lives. And that becomes very difficult. I had a man once say to me, I try to get the essence of what a person is saying, but after a while, I don't want them to be dumping garbage. I am not a garbage pail. And sometimes that happens in counseling. There needs to be that limitation, and here's a place where we need accountability. Here's a place where we need some of that supervision we were talking about in one of those questions that came up. We need to be sensitive, learning what we need to know, but being careful that we too are not involved in temptation, and it is so subtle. Because we recognize, don't we, that we are there sometimes before we even know that we're there. The devil doesn't very often hit us over the head and pull us into some kind of temptation. He gets to us in little bits, little pieces, slowly, just chipping away one little bit. And then we begin to wonder, how did I get here so smoothly? Watch out, lest you too be tempted. The good people helper is alert. And often that alertness comes with support from other people. So, the good people helper is spiritual, the good people helper is gentle, the good people helper is alert. Now, yesterday I quoted this next verse, carry one another's burdens. The good people helper is a burden bearer. Incidentally, you will notice that it talks about carrying one another's burdens. The good people helper is interested in carrying other people's burdens, but remember there are times when people need to come along and carry our burdens. We need to help one another. And that, I think, is where the church is so significant more than any other institution in the society. It ought to be an institution in which there is a perpetual, continual burden-bearing and caring for one another. We are to be burden-bearers. And we can ask God, Lord, show me how to be a good burden-bearer and where you want me to serve in this way. But carry each other's burdens, and in this way you will fulfill the law of Christ. I've already mentioned this. Remember what the law of Christ is? Jesus said, a new commandment I give you, that you love one another. I think love is the basis of good Christian counseling, because I think love is the basis of good Christian living. Jesus said that, by this shall all men know that you are my disciples if you love one another. So we need to be people characterized by love. Now, I don't know if you have come across this little expression. Yavis, Y-A-V-I-S. A couple of people are nodding their heads. That yes, we often like to counsel Yavis people. Yavis people are those people who are young, who are attractive, who are verbal, who are intelligent, and who are successful. Now, who would you like to counsel? I'd like to counsel these people. I don't want anybody who's kind of old and crotchety. I don't want people who are not attractive. I like to talk to people who are pleasant to be with. I don't want to talk with somebody who's nonverbal. How can you talk to those? How can you help those people? They're not even talking. They're not. You're supposed to listen. How can you listen if they don't talk? So you want people who talk freely. We want intelligent people. Who wants to counsel anybody who's stupid? And yet there are people like that, at least in my culture, and maybe even some in Australia. And what about people who are unsuccessful? Now, the Yavis people, regrettably, are the people who least need counseling. And they are the people who often go to the professional counselors and pay $150 an hour. The rest come to us. And they're not always pleasant to be with. And yet we often have to recognize that we are to show love. How do you show love for a non-Yavis people? Or a non-Yavis people. How do you show love for a non-Yavis person? Well, sometimes only with the help of God Himself. And you have to say, Lord, this one is a hard one for me. I'm struggling with this one. Please give me a sense of love for this individual. And I would guess that there are many here who have had that experience. And you get with these people and you begin to recognize that they may not be the most attractive people of the society, but you begin to see that I can learn to love those people, and I love them in a very special way, even though they don't have these characteristics of the Yavis individuals. And love becomes crucial. Now, as the passage goes by, it talks about humility. If anyone thinks he is something when he is nothing, he deceives himself. Each one should test his own actions, then he can take pride in himself without comparing himself to somebody else. See, it's very easy when we get involved in people helping to develop a sense of pride. Look at me. Look what I'm doing. Let me suggest to you that that can happen when you are teaching a class on people helping. It might even happen when you are giving a lecture on people helping. I can go bounding back and say, oh, I was just in Australia giving some talks. We must be very careful about that kind of thing. Because God gives us opportunities to serve. We must never forget that. And I try never to forget the fact that if I can speak, I'm grateful to God for that. And I could walk out in the front of this place and be hit by a car, and that could be the end of my speaking career. The chances are more likely that it will happen when I'm in Australia, because I always look the wrong way when I step off the curb. Julie is worse. I'm constantly pulling her back before she steps out and becomes another statistic. It's very easy. We spent all of these years of our life looking in a different direction. Well, we know then, don't we, that we have life for a short time. And we have gifts for a short time. And if God uses you to touch somebody else's life, to me that is just mind-boggling that that would happen. And we can be grateful for that and say, thank you, Lord, for giving me that opportunity. I realize I'm not smart enough to help anybody else. And think about that when you start counseling. None of us is really smart enough to know what to do. But if the Lord allows us to work with other people, that is a real cause for praise and for humility. That's no place for pride. Talks about each person carrying his own load. Didn't we just have something about carrying one another's burdens? Well, I'm told that this passage right here in verse 5 is talking about responsibility. So the good people helper is not only humble, the good people helper is aware of responsibility. Many times people have to take some responsibility for their problems and for their actions and for ways that they can change. And we need to help them with that. Because sometimes they don't want to change. And many questions came up yesterday. What do we do if they don't want to change? And many times we need to, in a gentle way, say, until you're willing to take some responsibility and until you're willing to change, I can't help you very well. Well, anyone who receives instruction, verse 6, in the Word, must share all good things with his instructor. That probably was referring to teachers in the local church who were paid. Now, some of you who are pastors will love this verse. It is saying, those who get instruction from the pastor ought to pay the pastor. You maybe want to preach on this tomorrow. Do you have the sermon ready? Some of you guys worried about? That'd be a good one. But think about it a little different way. This is going beyond the scripture. I recognize this. But it is saying the teacher is reimbursed by the student. I wonder if the counselor also gets things from the person who is counseled. Where do you do most of your learning? You come to seminars like this. I hope they're helpful. You read books. I hope they're helpful. You take courses, and there are several of them in Queensland and New South Wales and other parts of Australia, and we hope they're helpful. But we learn a lot from the people we interact with, don't we? Sometimes people say to me, Gary, why don't you like to write? Why don't you stop teaching? Why don't you just find a nice cabin someplace and write? Because I said, after about 3 months, I would dry up. Because you need to have people to stimulate you, don't you? And to encourage you and to give you fresh ideas. And we who are giving can learn from those to whom we give. And many times our counselees teach us much more than anybody else will teach us along the way. And there's a place where experience is a very good teacher. Well, do not be deceived. God cannot be mocked. A man sows what he reaps. Here we come talking again about the whole issue of responsibility. But let me move on to verse 9. Some of you who are counselors, if you haven't looked at this verse for a while, will love to think about it. Let us not become weary in doing good, for at the proper time we will reap if we do not give up. Has anybody ever been involved in counseling in this room and felt like giving up? Has anybody been involved in counseling who hasn't at some time felt like giving up? Giving up on counseling, giving up on this person that you're trying to work with who isn't making any improvement, and the scriptures come along when somebody's being restored, don't become weary. In due time there'll be some progress, but it takes a long time. That's why we have the burnout we talked about last night, because sometimes it takes a lot longer than we want. I was reading the other day about some pastor who was pacing up and down in his study. This is about 100 years ago, and somebody came in and said to him, "Why are you pacing up and down? What's the matter with you?" He says, "The problem is, I'm in a hurry, and God is not." I have noticed that. Somehow the Lord doesn't seem to fit my schedule. Did you like that, the way I said that? Sometimes He doesn't keep up with the things that I'm moving ahead on. And we want people to get better. Usually, we want them to get better quickly. It's the whole idea of, Lord, give me patience and give it to me quick. And that doesn't happen very often. And we have to stick with people. The good people helper, I suggest, is patience. And remember, one of the characteristics, one of the fruits of the Spirit is patience. Well, one other one. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all people, but especially to those who belong to the family of believers. I've had some good talks since I've been here with people who are church leaders, and they're concerned about meeting the needs not only of the churches or their congregations, but also their communities. If people helping is a route to evangelism, if people helping is pre-evangelism, as some people here have been using that term, if people helping is a pre-evangelism, we want to reach out, don't we? But it says here, we need to be reaching out to everybody, trying to do good to all people, but especially to those who are of the household of faith. Let us remember those people who are within our congregations. Somebody mentioned to me this morning about the paper I read yesterday from the person who had had this psychological disturbance and had been rejected by the church. And I was hearing a story about a family whereby one member of the family was in a hospital and nobody from the church came to visit. And the rest of the family, of course, was at home, and nobody came to visit them. In part because we don't know what to do. If that same member had had a heart attack, everybody would have been sending cards and sending flowers, and they would have visited as much as they could. They would have been preparing meals for the family at home and giving them all kind of support. But when the member of the family is in a psychiatric hospital, somehow we respond differently. Maybe because we feel uncomfortable, maybe because we don't quite know what to do. But we need to show that support and that love for people, regardless of the kinds of needs they have. And so we have a dual challenge here, to reach not only those who are in the communities, but those who are in the church. Now, these are some characteristics then of a people helper. And I begin this by suggesting that if we are going to be developing as people helpers, then start with yourself. And seeing how you are growing in your own spiritual life, how you're growing in your private worship, your private time with the Lord, the corporate worship, which becomes so important. I know people who are Christian counselors. They're Christians. I don't deny that. But they're not much involved in the local church. Their spiritual lives don't show very much dynamic. And I begin to wonder, I don't want to be judgmental, but I begin to wonder just where they are spiritually. And I think we probably have all seen this in people. Well, what about us? If we are going to be good people helpers, let's look at where we are spiritually. Okay, that's the first Bible reference. Remember? Two Bible references. Let's go to the second one. This is in the book of Job. Now, I know we have a number of Bible students here, and you, of course, will know where to find the book of Job. Others of you may be a little nervous because you don't want to look like you're flipping through the Bible and don't know where Job is. That can be embarrassing. Well, the first place you can do is be grateful that I'm not referring to Habakkuk. Secondly, if you have a full Bible, not just a New Testament, but a full Bible, you open it up in the middle and you come to what? Psalms. And then you go back one book and you're in Job. Isn't that wonderful? And you can all do that and everybody will think you are a Bible scholar even though you have no idea where Job is. Now you know. The book of Job is a marvelous book talking about stress. I used to give lectures on stress. I haven't done that recently, but I would always start with chapter 1 of Job. Because as the passage in Galatians talks about the characteristics of the people helper, this passage in Job talks about some of the techniques that are used by the people helper. You've got to get yourself growing in your relationship with the Lord. You start there. Then you start growing in your understanding and utilization of the skills. Now, Job was under stress. Like many of our counselees are under stress. And you'll remember the difficulties he had. He was a very wealthy man. He was a highly regarded man. He had a big family. He had all kinds of livestock running around. It says in verse 3 that he owned 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 donkeys, and a large number of servants. We had one dog once that just about threw me into a spasm with this kind of dog. I don't know how Job got along with all this. But nevertheless, you know what happened. He lost everything he owned. He had financial difficulties. He lost all of his family except one person. He had tremendous grief. The one person who did not go away was his wife. And his wife is mentioned in chapter 2. And she comes to him at one point and tells him that he ought to just curse God and die. And I can't quite see it here, but he says to her, it's either in the first or second chapter, he says to his wife, in verse 10 of chapter 2, you are talking like a foolish woman. Now, I can sense some problems right there. Because if you start telling your wife she's talking like a foolish woman, there's tension. There's going to be problems. And it's very interesting that in this entire book of Job, I think it's 42 chapters, Mrs. Job never appears again. So we don't know what happened. It may very well be that Job said, Lord, you took away my family. Why couldn't you have taken her too? But here is Job with some marriage problems. He also lost all of his status. See, Job was a man who was the greatest of men in all the East, and when he lost everything, lost all his money, he wasn't quite so important anymore. And the neighbors came by just to look at him and thought, isn't it interesting how the mighty have fallen? And here is Job struggling. And then, as I mentioned yesterday, along came three comforters, and they all do the wrong thing. They had a wonderful time preaching at Job, giving him nice little preconceived answers as to what was wrong, telling him how he ought to change, explaining to him that it was his fault for the problems he had. At one point, he says to these people, I think it's about chapter 9, he says, you're telling me things that I already know. You don't need to tell me this. I already know that stuff. Chapter 9, verse 1, I know what you're saying. That's not surprising to me. Then a few verses over, he says to another one of the comforters, you know, you sound like an old windbag. And he doesn't use those terms. But he said that what you're saying to me is like words blowing in the wind. You're not helping me one bit. And not only that, Job was not, he had all these problems he had to deal with. Then he had to deal with his counselor, and the counselors were creating more problems than he had to begin with. Which says something to us. Be very careful you don't add to the problem instead of solving the problem. Well, then comes a young man named Elihu. It's interesting. In chapter 32, he appears. Elihu, it gives his background in verse 6, and he starts to speak. I am young in years, and you are old. That is why I was fearful and not daring to tell you what I know. There are some cultures in this world where age becomes very important. About one or two times ago when I was in Japan, I was leaving a church after a series of lectures that I'd given, and there was two young girls there. I think they were probably college age. And so I held the door open for them. And they hesitated about going through the door. Finally, they went through, and they had this distressed look on their face, and they got to the side, and they said, Dr. Collins, we shouldn't have done that. You shouldn't have gone through the door. I said, no. I said, in our culture, we have a saying that says, ladies before gentlemen. I'm glad to open the door for you. And she said, no, but in our culture, we always let the old people go first. That was a little bit sobering for me to recognize. However, every time I go back, I have more respect. And when I come here, people ask me, well, tell me about your wife, tell me about your family. When I get there, the first question is, how old are you? And that becomes very important. Well, apparently it was important in this culture because Elihu didn't say anything. He said, I've been young and I've been keeping quiet. I've been listening to the older people. I thought age should speak. Advanced years should teach wisdom. And he goes on to point that out. But Elihu hadn't just been sitting there. Elihu had been showing some characteristics of a good counselor. Let me share several of them with you. Number one, Elihu apparently listened. Now, if you've taken any course in counseling, and I suspect you all have, you know that this is right at the core. And yet, I need to remind myself about that, don't you? I know Elihu listened because it tells us in verse 10, I therefore say, listen to me, I too will tell you what I know. I waited while you spoke. I listened to your reasoning while you were searching for words. I gave you my full attention. But not one of you, he's turning to the other counselors now, has proved Job wrong. Now, notice what Elihu is doing. I listened. I gave you my full attention. That is a marvelous illustration of what a good counselor does. Now, it's difficult at times to give people your full attention, especially if they are boring. Especially if they're telling you the same story for the fourth time. Especially if the room is warm. Some of you just discovered that. It's difficult to listen, isn't it? And yet Elihu apparently had listened very carefully. Why is it that we talk sometimes without listening? I wonder if it happens because we're uncomfortable. We don't know what to do. We don't know how to understand what's going on. We feel there's some pressure on us to counsel a person, and we're uncomfortable with silence, so we start talking. That, I think, is what the three comforters did. That is what we do sometimes when we go to visit somebody who's bereaved. And as soon as we go in, we think, what am I going to say to the person? I don't know what to say. Sometimes they don't want you to say much. Except, I'm here, and I want you to know how much I really care and how sorry I am. And maybe that's all they want. And they don't need a long exhortation as to why the person died when they did and all that sort of stuff. It's not always very helpful. And Elihu knew that giving his little talks at this point was not the best thing. Elihu listened and he gave his full attention to Job. And I suspect Job appreciated this because nobody to this point had listened. And Elihu knew this. In fact, we know Elihu begins to say this in verse 12. I gave you my full attention. Then he turns to the other counselors and he said, not one of you has proved Job wrong. None of you has answered his arguments. See, and Job must have sat back and thought, here is somebody who is, in a sense, understands me. Here is somebody who knows me enough and has spent enough time really listening to me that this person understands me. And I wonder how Job must have felt. I bet he felt a real sense of relaxation. Somebody understands me. So Elihu listened. That's number one. But secondly, Elihu expressed the fact that he cared. I suspect Job had no doubt about the fact that Elihu cared. Because he comes along and says to the other counselors, you didn't prove Job wrong. You haven't really taken this man seriously. Look at verse 3. Elihu is talking back to Job, and he says, my words come from an upright heart. My lips sincerely speak what I know. The Spirit of God has made me. The breath of the Almighty gives me life. Answer me then if you can. Prepare yourself and confront me. Elihu, look, I want to really grapple with you on these issues. And I want to really tell you what I think God is leading me to say. Let's work together on this. And this is a marvelous example of showing that he cares along the way. And here he is. I've listened. I know what you're struggling with. And I care about you. And that becomes crucial in our people helping. To express the fact that we care. Now, the third thing Elihu did was to identify with Job. We see this in verse 6. Job, he says, of chapter 33. I am just like you before God. I too have been taken from clay. No fear of me should alarm you, nor should my hand be heavy upon you. Elihu was saying, in essence, Job, my friend, I want to tell you something. I'm not coming in here as a high and mighty counselor who has it all together. I'm not a spiritual giant who is now going to look down upon you and tell you how to shape up and change your behavior. Look, I'm a fellow believer like you are. I too have feet of clay. Don't be alarmed by me. I want to identify with you. Did you notice last night we were talking about burnout? And I tried purposely to share some things about some of the times when I got burned out. Some of the things when I struggled, times when I struggled with issues. Because I think when we do that, we don't overdo it. When we do that, we identify with the people that we're with. And don't we do that in counseling? We're not going to overplay it. But sometimes to come along and say, I have some understanding where you're coming from because I too have struggled with issues. I too am growing. I too am walking along and in a progress towards a closer relationship with God. I'm not there yet, but I'm coming. And I think when people see that, they think, here is somebody who understands me. Look into your life. There may have been experiences that have been very painful for you, and you still don't know why you've had them. And yet, there may be times when, because you've had those experiences, you've got a rapport with somebody else that the rest of us don't have. Now, I don't want to push that too far, because that would say that if you want to help an alcoholic, you need to have been an alcoholic yourself. I don't believe that. I don't think if you want to help a troubled marriage that you have to have had troubled marriage yourself. I don't believe that. By the same token, if you have had some painful experiences, very often this gives you a rapport with other people that you might not have. When Julie and I got married, we had a young man who was in our wedding party, who was very much interested in serving the Lord, very much interested in going on in the ministry. He went off to theological seminary, spent some time on the mission field, but he developed a form of cancer. Young man. His wife said to him one day, he'll never reach 40. This was a man that wanted to be a doctor. He really wanted to be a doctor. And he didn't quite do well enough on his chemistry test. And his chemistry examinations, he didn't quite make it in terms of getting into graduate school. He thought, well, maybe I can help people through the ministry. He was a sincere Christian. He wasn't thinking of this as a second-class thing. But, okay, since I'm not going to get into medical school, I'll work and I'll go into the ministry. And then he gets this debilitating cancer. Well, over the period of years, he was treated. He spent a lot of time in the hospital, a lot of painful chemotherapy. And apparently, several years ago, the cancer was completely eradicated. He must be now close to 50. But he is having a phenomenal impact as a hospital chaplain. And here he is, in the medical setting where he wanted to work, ministering to people like he wanted to minister to him. And he understands the medical side from being in the hospital and from being patient. He understands the theological side from his theological training, but he sure understands where some of those people are coming from, and he knows about their family. Here is somebody who can identify with those patients. In fact, he is moving this coming couple of months to a new position where he's going to be overseeing a group of chaplains who are working in general hospitals. Now, that was a case where his experience was useful. And people who are good people helpers, I think, recognize we can identify with the person and try not to be those people who are somehow superior or above them. And I think, incidentally, that flows out of the kind of people we are, doesn't it? Well, this man next summarized what he had heard. That's a good technique. After you listen to a person for a while, you can summarize. Now, let me see. Am I right? What you have been saying is this. And that kind of summary can help, because it lets the person know that you have listened to them. It also lets the other person check if you've reached any misunderstandings. Is this what you are saying? Let me try to summarize it. Job hears this kind of a summary in chapter 33, verse 8. Here's what Elihu says. You have said in my hearing, Job, I heard these very words. Now, if your translation is like mine, verse 8 has quotation marks at the beginning to say this is Elihu speaking. Verse 9 has that one little quote, you know, not the two blips, but the one blip, which says it's a quote within a quote. And so Elihu is saying, now, Job, listen, is this what I heard? Is this what I heard you say? Did you, Job, say this? I am pure and without sin. I am clean and free from guilt. Yet God has found fault with me. He considers me his enemy. He fastens my feet in shackles. He keeps close watch on all my paths. Unquote.
Job, is that what you've been saying? Look, in three short verses, Elihu quotes what Job has been trying to say for the last 33 chapters.
See? Now, I wonder how Job felt about that. Somebody understands. And somebody has pulled together the essence of what I'm grappling with. Sometimes that's all your counseling needs. Or the main thing the counseling needs. Is kind of get a summary of what's really going on, an encapsulation of the problem. Here is what we have to deal with. And Elihu summarized. I suspect that was helpful for Job. But then, look what Elihu does in chapter 11. But I tell you, you are not right. Jay Adams would love that. It's a confrontation kind of thing. Now, sometimes you need to do this. I would like to suggest, however, that confrontation is a word that has got a negative connotation. Because sometimes we assume that if you confront a person, you are going to have to somehow, in a bombastic manner, hit them with what they're doing wrong and tell them to shape up and change. That could be confrontation, but I think confrontation is really pointing out things to people that they haven't seen or maybe that they don't want to see. And I think in that respect, it's a basic form of teaching. And I mentioned yesterday that we've had several people here, and several of the questions that have not been answered yet are questions about teaching. Several of you have asked me about that at the coffee breaks. What about teaching and counseling? I suggest that much of what we are doing is teaching. And much of counseling is a specialized form of education. Maybe a one-to-one form of education or a two-to-one form of education. Special education. And Christian counseling is really a specialized form of Christian education. You are teaching people to see their problems in a different light. You are teaching people some skills. You are teaching people some insights. You are teaching people the way the Scripture applies to their problems. So much of what you're doing is teaching. And this, I think, is what Elihu did. He began to teach Job. But a good teacher just doesn't lecture and then not give any kind of response, any time for response. The best teachers, I suspect, are those that have time for interaction. I enjoy being here. It's exciting to me to see how many people have come. The committee that planned this is surprised and delighted. There's a hunger for information on counseling in this part of Australia. And we have, as we've talked about, as Julie and I have talked about it, and some of us have talked about it individually. It's exciting to see what this conference is going to stimulate. Somebody said to me last night, we may look back on this conference in years to come and say, this was a turning point in terms of Christian counseling here in Australia, in this part of Australia, maybe for a large part of Australia. And I sense that. I want to share a little bit more about that tonight. But I think this could be a significant turning point. There's an interest in this. There's an excitement about this. But it's much more helpful if we can have time for interaction. And for me to give lectures, that's only one part of it. When I was involved in teaching full time, we used to have a little seminar in our home once a week. It's a wonderful seminar. It's the one I like best. We used to meet around our dining room table. Now, our dining room table is not all that big. The most we could get is 8 people. So the dean of the college allowed me to keep the seminar limited to 8 students. They would come to our house once a week. They'd arrive at 7 o'clock. And we after getting together, we start our seminar at 7:30, and the plan was to go until 9 or 9:15, but sometimes those kids were, those students were still around by 10 or 10:30, and sometimes 11. Because we had a chance to interact, and we spent time talking with each other. That was really exciting. Incidentally, I should mention that the excitement of the seminar may not have been my dynamic teaching. See, because between the hour of 7 o'clock and 7:30, they came for dessert. And Julie would make a different one each week. And so I think they came for the goodies, and then they had to endure the seminar. Nevertheless, we had a good time together. And that's one of the things that I most miss about teaching, because we had a chance to share things, to confront each other on some ideas, and to interact. Now, this is exactly what Elihu does. He talks to Job. He teaches Job some things. He says, Job, let me point out some things you haven't heard. But then he says in verse 31, but Job, listen to me and be silent and I will speak. But if you have anything to say, answer me. Speak up, for I want you to be clear. Job, don't just sit there passively listening to me. I want to interact with you. And isn't that a lot of what counseling involves? We share things with people. Now, what do you think about this? Let's work together on this. Helper and the person being helped. We'll work together. We'll try to do some teaching, but we'll interact back and forth like we used to do around our dining room table. And Elihu confronted and he taught. But if you were to continue to read through this book, you would discover very quickly that Elihu pointed Job to God. He reminded Job about what God was like, the nature of God, the goodness of God, despite the terrible stresses that Job was under. And Job began to recognize that I have not had the right attitude along the way, that I have misunderstood what God is trying to do. And God eventually comes back to a place of significance in Job's life. And you get to the end of the book, you don't know whether it's Elihu talking or whether it's God talking. And maybe it doesn't matter. Now, let me suggest something that might seem kind of radical. Is it possible that God sometimes speaks to people through what you say? That He uses you to touch another life? I think that happens all the time. And sometimes we don't even know that the Lord is doing that. And if you go into counseling, ask the Lord to help you to understand and to say the things that He would have you to say. And sometimes you might be amazed at what the Holy Spirit does as He encourages you in that direction. And here is Elihu as a counselor who listens, who shows that he cared, who identified with Job, who summarized what Job said, who confronted and taught Job but gave him time to respond, and who pointed Job ultimately to God later on. Now, I would be remiss if I suggested that this is the way everybody ought to counsel. Sometimes we look at Jesus on the road to Emmaus. I think He used a different approach. Look at Jesus with the woman at the well. He took somewhat of a different approach. Look at how He handled the woman caught up in adultery, caught in the very act of adultery. He took a little bit of a different approach. Look at how Nathan confronted David. He took a different approach. And as we look through the Scriptures, we see many examples of that we might not call counseling, but many examples of people helping. And there are different approaches. But let me suggest that some of these things that I mentioned here this morning might be a good model for you to keep in mind as you're concerned about people helping. Now, some of you may be getting a little nervous. You may notice that it's almost 11:30. Gary said he had two Bible passages, two diagrams, and two lists. If he spends as much time on the diagrams and the lists as he's talking on the Bible passages, we won't have any time for lunch. Well, let's work a little more quickly on the two diagrams. One of them I'm going to deal with quite quickly because I put it in a book that I wrote several years ago called How to Be a People Helper. And I'd like to elaborate on this diagram a little bit beyond what I do in the book. But I think this will help us as we look at some of our techniques. You may remember, if you looked at the book, that I talked in there about the fact that counseling always is going to involve at least two people. There is the helper, and there is the person who comes for help. Sometimes we'll use the term helpee, although that seems kind of awkward. But nevertheless, the person who gets the help. And you may remember, if you've seen the book, that I suggested there are three general ways, this is an oversimplification, but three general ways by which we help people. Sometimes we help people in a more directive way, whereby the helper tells the other person what to do. Often that is a confrontational way. Among Christian counselors, Dr. Adams calls himself a confrontational counselor. And he, I think, would be quite happy to be identified with this approach. Let me suggest to you that Christians are often inclined to use that approach because we work on the assumption that we have the Scriptures and the Scriptures are relevant to people's needs. And we want to share from the Scriptures, so we are more likely to be sharing things with individuals than sometimes telling people how they ought to change. That's one general approach. A second general approach is one that goes the other way. And this is an approach that says we're going to let the helpee do most of the talking. It's not going to be like the first approach where the helper tells the individual what to do. This second approach is the bottom. The person with a problem does most of the talking while the helper listens. So in the top one, a lot of the talking comes from the helper. In the bottom one, a lot of the talking comes from the person who is helped. Now, why is that helpful? Because sometimes as you talk about a problem, as you put it into words, things get clarified. Let me see if I can relate to you students. Have you ever had to write a term paper? Maybe the same would apply to some of you who are preachers and you've had to prepare a sermon. And you're in the shower some morning and you get this marvelous idea for this paper or this sermon. And it becomes, just as you think about it, it just gets to be a marvelous thing. And it's all there, all arranged, and so wonderful. So you jump out of the shower and you get out a piece of paper and you write down what you've got. And you discover that there maybe isn't an awful lot there. Sometimes that happens with our problems. The problem rumbles around in our mind. It just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Then you sit down and talk to somebody and say, well, let me see if I can put in a few words what my problem is. And you think, oh, well, now I can see it in a whole different light. Maybe it's not quite as big as I thought it was. Maybe now I can see what I ought to do about it. And sometimes the person will talk about a problem and the helper sits there and says, mm-hmm, a couple of times. And the person says, oh, thank you very much. You're a wonderful counselor. And walks out and you kind of look and think, what do I do? Now, that does happen. Now, in terms of Christian counseling, the whole early pastoral counseling movement was very much in this way. This is kind of the non-directive or the client-centered approach. In the secular field, Albert Ellis is a good example of the directive approach. Carl Rogers was a very good example of the client-centered, that was his term, or the more non-directive approach. And much of the early work in clinical pastoral education, CPE, took that more non-directive type of approach. Now, when I went to Switzerland with my family to spend a year trying to understand the work of Paul Tournier, the reason I went there was because 20 years ago, I wanted to spend some time with somebody who was integrating Christianity with psychology, and Tournier was the only person I could think of. That's only 20 years ago. But so much has changed in these past two decades. But nevertheless, Tournier would probably put himself in the middle. Tournier being Christian. Because Tournier said, well, I'm not there to tell people. I'm not a confronter. But I'm also not likely to sit back and just listen to somebody and say, mm-hmm. Tournier said, what I'd really like to do, and that's probably not a fair statement of what they're doing down here. Obviously, it's much more complicated than that. But Tournier said, I like to get with people and sit down next to the fireplace, man to man, person to person. It's not doctor-patient relationship, it's brother to brother, that kind of thing. And we'll sit down and we'll talk about the problem and what we might do about it. And that was Tournier's perspective. It was more of an interactional approach in the middle. And certainly, back in those days, Glasser, who hasn't written very much recently, William Glasser developed that approach. For me personally, there was one time in my training when I went through a more traditional type of training. I knew about the Rogerian approach. I knew about the directive approach. I was trained in a school where there was a lot of emphasis on the learning approach, teaching people how to respond differently. But I felt uncomfortable with much of what I learned in graduate school. And I came out with a doctorate in clinical psychology and still felt uncomfortable. And then one day I read an article about William Glasser. And there is an L in his name, not Glasser, Glasser. Okay? All right. Glasser, how many did not pick that up? Two people. Yeah, okay. All right. Glasser, I read this article about Glasser. And he said, I don't wear a white coat. He said, I dress like they do in Australia. He didn't say that. But he said, I wear informal clothes. And we sit down and we relax. We don't have to come and me sit in an office with a suit behind the desk. People call me Bill. They don't call me Dr. Glasser. See, he was more on an interactional approach. And I related to that immediately. Because in all my teaching career, I say to students, don't call me doctor, call me Gary. I was Gary long before I was doctor. And let's interact more on this interaction basis in the middle here. Now, what is the correct approach to counseling? And where ought we be doing our people helping? Which is biblical and which is not? Well, it depends on several things. Of course, it depends on who you ask. But let me suggest, and of course I can say that my way is the right way, but I won't do that. Let me suggest that counseling can take place any place along that red line. And where you are on that red line is going to depend on several things. It's going to depend first on your personality. See, Dr. Adams and Albert Ellis, they're both confrontational type people. That's part of their personality. Tournier said to me one day, he said, I can't confront people very well. It's not my personality to do so. I know of other people who are much more inclined to listen, and they feel comfortable doing that. Carl Rogers seemed to enjoy that, seemed to appreciate that. Paul Tournier's personality, and I suppose mine was much, is more in the middle. Let's sit around the table and have a class around our dining room table. Let's sit down and talk one-to-one in a coffee shop informally. I like to do that. That's exciting to me. It's more interactional. So to some extent it's going to depend on your style. I suggest on your own personality. To some extent, it probably depends on your training, but to some extent it depends on the counselee and the counselee's problems. Let's suppose somebody comes to you who is grieving. Maybe it's a widow and she's lost her husband of many years and it's very, very difficult for her. She doesn't want to be confronted and told, come on, shape up. Where's the joy of the Lord? Let's get going again. Obviously, that's not what you want. And she might want a little bit of interaction here, but I think she wants somebody to be with her and to listen to her and to care for her. That's what she wants down here. But I know some other people who want what we used to call in graduate school a kick in the pants kind of therapy. They need a little push. They need more than that. They need a little boot. They need to keep moving because somehow they need somebody to confront them. And maybe you need to do this even if you're not comfortable there. So you can probably look on this line and decide kind of where you might fit. And it may very well be that if you're down here, you help a different type of people than if you're up here. Does J. Adams help people? I have no doubt about it. Because for some people, he relates to people the way they need to be related to. Does he help all people? I don't think so. But maybe nobody in this room can help all people. Because of our backgrounds, because of our personalities, because of the individuals, because of their problems. Now, I would suggest to you that during your counseling, during your people helping, most of us should start down here at the bottom. Because I think if we start at the bottom, we listen. I'll get to my second diagram in a minute. We listen. And probably as we counsel, we may move any place along this red line, but in general, we probably move up. And we listen to the person, get a perspective on what the problem is, but then slowly we interact, and maybe at some time we need to give some clear direction, but we start slowly move up. This is what Elihu did. He listened. He understood. He showed that he cared. Then he started interacting with Job, and we really got to the point of confronting Job for a while back there. But he said to Job at one point, let's interact a little bit about what I'm saying. Tell me what you think. So let me suggest to you that there can be this diversity. I appreciate the people who have written in this field. And some people have written in Christian counseling, they've written very fine books. I may not agree with them all, but nevertheless, some of those books are very, very good. We don't agree with everybody who writes. And these are some fellow brothers and sisters. But I get nervous when somebody comes along and says, my way is the way to counsel. Because I suspect we have many ways to counsel, many ways to be people helpers. And maybe this little diagram will help you to take some of the systems that are out there, some of the theories, and put them in place. So I know this is simple, and some of the systems are very hard to fit into this. Some of the questions that have come up on New Age movement, for example, they're hard to fit into this, but it's a simple diagram, but maybe a model to keep in mind. Okay, if I take it off? Okay, let me go then to the second diagram of the two that I want to share with you. Sometimes I think it is helpful to ask ourselves, can we have something in mind as we counsel that may be useful? Something to kind of guide us as we're helping people. Let me suggest a little six-stage picture that might help you. Number one, I think in any kind of relationship, you've got to first build a relationship. If you want to take a nice psychological word, you are developing rapport. This, again, is what Elihu did. He listened. And when he came to Job, he said, Job, I'm younger. I want you to know that I'm a person who respects those who are older. Maybe Job was older than him. I've been listening carefully to you. I want to summarize what I've been hearing. And I think right at that point, he was building rapport with Job. This is one place where pastoral counselors have a unique advantage because they build rapport with their congregations long before counseling starts. Because every time some of you people get up into a pulpit or you get into any kind of a teaching situation, people watch you and they begin to see what kind of a person you're like. And they've had a chance to observe you, maybe for many Sundays and other times, and said, well, I think I could talk to that person about a problem. Professional counselor can't do that. You may look up a name in a phone book or go on the basis of somebody's recommendation. It's better, incidentally, to find a recommendation than to look up a name in a phone book. But you may get a recommendation, go to some professional. You've never met that person. What's he going to look like? Is he going to be a mind reader? Is he going to be critical? And you, many people come to professionals threatened. And there has to be a period of rapport building. Lay people often can build rapport more quickly than some of those of us who are professionals can. But we need to build the relationship. Once we build it, we start, and this is something that's ongoing. It goes on all the time. It's not something you do for the first session or first half hour and then forget about it. You must constantly be working on that relationship. Then, let me suggest we go around a circle. At some time, you need to clarify the issue. What is it that this person is concerned about? It may be one issue. It's more likely to be several issues. Maybe you need to, here's a place where you need to listen. You need to ask some questions. What is it that you are really struggling with? What are you concerned about? Let the person, to use a phrase that sometimes appears in the literature, let the person tell his or her story. What are you concerned about? How can you help a person if you don't know what the problem is? A physician doesn't treat you until he or she knows what your problem is. Here is what you're doing as a professional, or as a professional, as a pastoral counselor, as a lay counselor, whatever, wherever you are in this system, you need to clarify issues. And let me suggest that this is something that may be ongoing. But let's assume that after a while you begin to see, well, this person's got a marriage problem. Or it seems to me this person's really struggling with his or her career. Or maybe this person is in midlife and really grappling because he or she has not succeeded in accordance with some earlier dreams. Or maybe the kids aren't turning out right. Or maybe here's a person who's concerned about how am I going to make financial ends meet? Or what am I going to do about my elderly parents? Or what am I going to do about maybe a physical problem I have with one of my kids who's ill and I'm concerned about that? You begin to clarify the issues. Now, as you do this, sooner or later, you're going to want to explore some alternatives, some things to do. Now, let me suggest that you begin by asking the person, what have you tried? What I'm doing is drawing a circle here with four parts in the circle, if you can't see it over here on this side. You explore the alternatives. You might say, what have you tried? How have you tried to deal with this problem? What has worked? What has not worked? Because by the time a person talks to you, he or she has probably been thinking about this. And has maybe tried some things. And some things have seemed to work and some things haven't worked. Find out what's worked and what hasn't worked. Maybe you want to think about some things. Well, I wonder what we might try. Let's talk about some things that we might do. And those kinds of things you might explore for a long time. And as you start exploring, you may find yourself slipping back here to clarify the issue again. Fourthly, you at some time need to stimulate some change. Basically, you are trying to encourage the person to change. To change what? Maybe to change his or her thinking. Maybe to change his or her feelings in some way. Maybe to change his or her behavior. Sometimes I use this little diagram here. It also appears in the book where I make the comment that in any kind of situation, we are people who have feelings, we are people who have thinking, and we are people who act. And these three things have a bearing on each other. And how you feel, if you feel depressed, it's going to influence how you think, and it's going to influence how you act. If you're depressed, your actions are going to reflect it. And if you are a person who thinks that you're no good or incompetent, then you're going to feel down, and you're going to act in accordance with the way you think. If you think I'm no good, I can't understand it, I'm going to fail at school, if I go on to the university, then you're going to act in that way and often have a self-fulfilling prophecy. And if you are a person who does something that is foolish or sinful or shows you're incompetent, many times you're going to feel bad because of what you've done, and it's going to affect your thinking. Now, sometimes we don't know how to help people. Many times we start with their feelings, and they express their feelings, but it's hard to tell people to change their feelings. If somebody says, I'm depressed, and you say, oh, don't be depressed. It's not going to help one iota. Maybe you've got to change some of their thinking a little bit and help them change some of their actions. Now, a lot of what you're doing here is stimulating some change. Because now after you've explored what's going on, you start to stimulate some ways that they can change. Maybe they've got to change the way they act. Stop their sinful behavior. Learn to react to people in different ways. Learn some different skills for interpersonal relationships. Maybe they've got to change their thinking. Maybe they've got some thinking within their own minds that is creating problems. Some talk, self-talk they keep telling themselves that really drags them down. Maybe you've got to do something about some of their feelings, let them express their feelings, let them admit their feelings, and be aware of what the feelings are. You've got to stimulate change. Now, incidentally, it's difficult sometimes to get to number three, to number four. Last night I mentioned that Julie and I had both put on a little bit of weight because of what we've been eating here. Now, we've already clarified the issue. About 5 pounds. We've also explored the alternatives. We can ignore it. We can hope it'll go away by osmosis. Or we can go on a diet as soon as we get home. Now, we can stop right there. We can go home and say, we're going to go on a diet. And we can be still talking about that next Christmas. See, and a lot of people stay there. They know what to do. But somehow we've got to step out and take the change. And we stimulate each other. I know we'll do it because we've been through this before. We've discovered that 5 pounds up and down is easier than 30 pounds up and down. So when we see the 5 pounds, that's when we start working on it. But we stimulate change. And you've got to, sometimes you need to encourage a person to change because they know what they've got to do, but it's hard to do that. They know they have to break off a relationship, but it's hard to do that. They know they have to change their behavior or thinking in some way, but it's hard to do that. And you stimulate that. Now, is that going to work? Well, this gets us to number five. We need to evaluate what's happened. You may say to the person, why don't you go home and act in a different way towards your spouse this week and let's see what happens. So we try, and then the person goes back and we say, well, how did it work? Let's evaluate the results. And the person may say, well, it didn't work very well. Well, let's go back and talk about why. Let's go back and look at the issue again. Maybe we need to re-clarify the issue and explore some alternatives and stimulate some change and try something again. And the person may say, well, yes, my marriage seems to be going very well, but you know, as my marriage is going well, now I'm discovering I'm having some problems with my career. And you discover that as you start changing one area, another issue starts to evolve. So maybe you have to go around the circle again. And you may just kind of go around the circle. Don't forget that relationship. But you need to keep going around that circle, maybe for a long period of time. Be careful. Have that patience. In due time we will reap if we do not grow weary going around in circles. Okay? Then eventually you get to the point where it looks like the person is doing okay. And at that point, sometimes you break out of this circle at some point. Maybe at a different point, maybe one of these different points, you break out of the circle and basically, number six, you end the counseling relationship or end the helping relationship. Don't guess I like what I'm writing down here. Because I'm not suggesting that you drop the person. I'm not sure that if you're the pastor, you say, well, too bad, we got you all solved, I hope we don't talk anymore. Basically, what you're doing is ending that kind of a counseling or helping relationship. You may still go on and know the person and spend time with the person. You may say, look, if you want to come back and talk again, I'd love to have you do it. And you're going to get into this very quickly because you've already built the relationship and you're already set to go. But basically, this is what we call termination. Be careful. Our goal is not to keep people tied to us. Our goal is to stimulate people so they can go out and function on their own. Okay? These are the two diagrams. Now, what about the two lists? Let me mention these very quickly. Number one, list number one. Let me suggest some guidelines for effective listening. Maybe you just need to be reminded about this. Here are some suggestions about listening. Number one, prepare to listen. Expect that you're going to listen. And be ready for it. Sometimes you find yourself listening when you weren't expecting to listen. Like when you go in to say goodnight to one of your kids and the kid starts talking. And you begin to recognize, hey, these are significant things that are coming up. I wasn't expecting this now. But I'm going to take the time to listen. Or like when you're riding home with somebody in the car and they start talking, sharing something with you and you suddenly recognize, now is the time that I have to listen. And we need to be ready for that. And if we're going to be effective counselors, we don't just listen when we're involved in the counseling mode. We become sort of listeners all the time. Prepare for it. Expect it. Secondly, let me suggest that you be aware of content and delivery. See, content is what the person says. Delivery is how the person says it. There's a difference. And you can learn from both. A person can say, I'm really sad. Suppose the person says, boy, I'm really sad today. You think, no, wait a minute. The content says I'm sad. The behavior is inconsistent with that. And so it's very important then that you kind of look at things like voice pitch, the speed at which the person talks, how the person is sitting, is he or she shifting in his chair, that kind of thing. Look at those. Look for those kinds of things. The content and the ways in which the person speaks, the delivery. Number three, be aware of your own emotions. Sometimes how you listen depends on how you feel. It's hard to listen when you're tired. You discover that. We all know that. But it's hard to listen when you're angry. And it's hard to listen when you're sad. And it's hard to listen when you're preoccupied with something else. Very difficult for you to listen to somebody else when you're worried about your own family or your own career or something that you've got to deal with later on today. So at least if you're aware yourself of those emotions, often that'll color how you listen to another person. So at least be aware of yourself. Number next, watch out for distractions. I think this is number four. You can be distracted by what you hear so that your mind begins to wander. Or sometimes you can be distracted at what you see, so you start gazing out the window. I mean, let me tell you about sermons in America. Sometimes sermons in America are boring. I know this comes as a great shock to you. And when that happens, the people who sit in the rows get distracted, and their minds wander. I've read about this. And they don't always listen to what is being said. Now, if you ever have known anybody who's had that experience, you know what happens in your counseling, right? Sometimes counselees are as boring as preachers. I'm in trouble. Some preachers. Okay. Very difficult to listen to. A lecture was boring. Hard to pay attention. What do you do if a counselee is boring? Then it's easy to have your mind wander. If that happens, ask yourself, why is my mind wandering? What's going on here in me so that I'm not willing to pay attention to that person? What's going on? And maybe a good reason. I'm warm, I'm distracted, and I'm frustrated in some way. But maybe there's a good reason why your mind is wandering. Maybe you feel a little threatened. Ask yourself, why is my mind wandering the way it is? Number five, encourage further sharing. See, I joked a little bit about Carl Rogers saying, mm-hmm. But mm-hmm is not a bad response. And you can't write that in your book because you don't know how to write mm-hmm. You don't know how to spell it. Okay. But sometimes just to nod your head and say mm-hmm encourages the person to continue talking. Or you can say things like, tell me more about that. Or could you clarify that a little bit? That kind of thing keeps the person going and helps you to listen. The more you listen, that helps you and it helps your counselee to put things into words. Remember, ask questions sparingly. You start asking questions, you start taking control of the interview in ways that may not be helpful. Watch out especially for questions of why, because that gets people off into a nice academic discussion of why things are going on, and that can often get away from some of the more sensitive issues that you're concerned about. And recognize that there are different kinds of questions. Closed-ended questions are questions that have a short answer, like, did you grow up in Queensland? Yes or no? No. Are you married? Yes or no? Do you have any children? Yes or no? But a question like, tell me about yourself, requires more of an answer. That's a more open-ended question. What have you been struggling with lately? That's a more open-ended question. And those questions usually will keep people talking, as you well know. Try not to interrupt. Sometimes we get interruptions, and that gets us off in the way, unless you find the person rambling off away from the main point and you need to pull the person back. Try to avoid preaching or lecturing or giving advice, or arguing. We all know that, but we forget about it. Sometimes preaching lecturing, giving advice, or arguing can get in the way. Next one, listen for themes. You might find something to keep coming up on a regular basis. That's a clue to what the problem might be. And one more. Try not to get carried away by your own curiosity. Your purpose in listening is to understand the person and to be helpful to the person, not to satisfy your own curiosity or your own personal needs. We've had the two Bible passages. We've had the two diagrams. We've had one list. Can you handle one more list if I keep it short? I mean, you're not going to say no, are you? And you're too gracious for that. Okay, let me try and do it quickly. Here are some, we talked about some listening skills. Here are what I would call some influencing skills. After you listen, how can you influence people? What can you do as you explore alternatives and stimulate some change? What are some listening skills? Remember, there's value sometimes in restating a problem, rephrasing it, or summarizing it. That's what Elihu did. You can say, I've been listening to you for the last 5 minutes. Let me see if I can summarize what you said. Let me see if I can restate what you said. Maybe in some way I can say it in a different way. Is what you're really saying, is this what it is? There's value in doing that. And that often helps the person and stimulates the counseling along. Now, a minute ago, I suggested that you not be arguing or giving advice, but sometimes it's helpful to give information, to give instruction, to give some suggestions. This can be helpful to people. They don't often want to just sit there and talk. They like those kinds of things to come from you, especially if you do it in a tentative way and let the person respond, like Elihu did, as he gave Job some suggestions and some guidelines along the way. Number three, occasionally there's value in self-disclosure. The helper can express his or her own thoughts and feelings at times. This is controversial, I agree. Sometimes you might say, you know, from my perspective, or I once encountered something like. Those kinds of things help people because it helps identify them with you, and sometimes it helps them to get a better perspective on the problem. You know, I once went through a grief reaction too, and I noticed this in me. I wonder if this is what's happening in you. So you're not focusing on yourself, but you're just making a brief self-disclosure there. Occasionally, you might want to give some feedback. This is what I'm seeing. As I listen to you, this is what I think is going on. Is this right? Here again, you present things sort of tentatively. You don't want to be judgmental. You want to be as helpful as you can be. Try not to give a whole bunch of information. People can accept one piece of information. It's hard to accept a lot of information. Some of you have discovered this morning. We discover when we come to a conference like this, it's hard to get a lot of information. Our brains, after a while, begin to get overloaded, don't they? Any kind of a conference. We try with a person just to give them one piece of information at a time. You might also at some time talk to some people about the logical consequences. If you keep going in this direction, what do you think is going to happen? And point out to them what's going to happen to them if they don't make some changes. And then at times you might want to give them some directives, some instruction or some guidelines on what to do. Maybe even some advice, although be careful how you phrase that. And occasionally you might want to confront people with their sinful behavior, with inconsistencies in their lives, or with other things that need to be changed. Now, I have noticed that the room is getting progressively hotter. Have you noticed that? And you people are showing this marvelous ability to still stick with me. But I've been going here, according to my watch, for an hour and 15 minutes at least. Maybe some of you will challenge me. No, it was really an hour and 18, Gary. Let's take a brief stretch-up break, and then we'll look at some of the questions that have come in and see what questions you might have about these issues.
He has there, and if you have any other questions that you'd like to write out, please write them out and pop them in here, because we won't be accepting any questions that are not in here after lunch. Just one question, Gary, and that's in relation to the issue of some of us involved in equipping lay people helpers. Mm-hmm. Could you just make a couple of observations in terms of effective strategies in doing that?
Yeah, I appreciate that. I appreciate your raising that because I think that's a significant issue. I mentioned yesterday a book by Sin Yang Tan, and Sin Yang, in writing this book, he's looked into the literature on lay counseling, and there's a tremendous amount of literature on this. T-S-I-A-N... I don't know. The last name is Tan, T-A-N.
Okay, that's not right. No, it's Sin Yang.
Have I got it there? T-S-I-N-G-Y-N-G, I think.
The book is available at Kura Bookshop.
Okay, good. It's three... Do we want one? Anyhow, his last name is Tan. I think it's S-I-N-G-Y-A-N-G. I may have left the letter out. The Sin Yang... That's right. That's Y-A-N. Y-A-N in the middle. Sin Yang Tan. Anyhow, the last name is Tan. It's published by Zondervan Publishing House. And I think if you go in and ask for the book by Dr. Tan, published by Zondervan Publishing House, Sin Yang Tan nice try. I think it's S-I-A-N-G-Y-A-N-G. The name of the book, I think, is Lay Counseling. Now, in this book, Dr. Tan looks into the question that Peter just raised, and how you train lay counselors. Now, one of the struggles that I've had since I've been here, maybe I should clarify that a little bit. One of the struggles that I've had since I've been here is to ask the question, to what extent do we deal with issues on more techniques, and to what extent do we deal with issues that are more direction, where are we kind of going? Now, I think most of the sessions that I've been asked to do, and I really appreciate the outlines, most of the sessions have really been talking about this very question that was just raised. How do we equip people? How do we train people? How do we move in that direction? But in this one session that we just had, I took a little different approach and talked more about some techniques and more of the kinds of things we've done, or we do in counseling, so we can focus on that. Now, in terms of setting up a lay counseling program, as I mentioned yesterday, you have to be concerned about several things. You have to be concerned about selection. Now, there are all kinds of theories on selection. Tan talks about that in his book. Do you let everybody come, or do you choose carefully on this with some people? I wrote an article about this. I may have a copy with me that probably I could leave and have it duplicated. But it wrote several years ago in Leadership Magazine. You need to be a little careful who you select. Then you need to come up with a training program. Now, there are training programs that exist out there. The People Helper program is one, but that's a program that I developed several years ago. There are other programs that are more recent. Some churches I know use Corey's book. But Corey's book is strictly secular and has no real... Gerard Egan, E-G-A-N. But he's got a very good approach on training people in people helping skills. So you've got to think about what kinds of information do you need to go into that. And many times you need to sit down and work that out, I think, yourself, especially with people around who can help, but also with some of these people who have written about this. And there is research that has been accumulated on what training techniques you use. Then the third question you have to ask is, how are you going to use the people after they're trained? Where are they going to be placed, and how are we going to use them? Who is going to supervise them if somebody supervises them? And I think that probably should be done. Do they know how to make referrals? That's one of the things that they are going to be taught along the way. So I think the question of selection, training, and utilization are the three major topics. And there are a group of theories, I suppose, that have been written in this area. Now, it is difficult. This is one of those questions that I've had several that is difficult to summarize in just a few paragraphs, obviously. I think Tan's book will help. There's another book came out on peer counseling by Bear, B-E-A-R, and Stuckey, S-T-U-C-K-I. Bear and Stuckey. It may be the other way around. It may be Stuckey and Bear, but it's called peer counseling. That approach, these are two people, one is a pastor and one is a psychiatric social worker. These two people have written a book in which they describe how they have set up peer counseling, and they refer to a number of churches who have peer counseling programs, and they summarize the peer counseling programs in these churches. That book, the Tan book, is published by Zondervan. The Stuckey and Bear book is published by Word. I know of another man who is now beginning work on a third book in this area who feels that these first two books have not really dealt with it in a way that it should be, that is as clear as it should be in terms of how it's been developed. I think we're on the verge of something that is developing as a new approach, and I think these other people you can draw on. I'll bring in that article this afternoon, and you can have a look at that. But then I think maybe you need to have a look at where you are, the kinds of people you deal with, and build programs that draw on these other ones that have been established. But build programs that are adaptable to the culture. I've been asked a couple of times while I've been here, how do you take some of these counseling principles that maybe third world cultures or maybe places where they don't have very much counselor training? Well, here again, you have to understand the people that you're trying to reach, have to understand the culture, it becomes very important, and then see, okay, what are the needs in that culture? How do they perceive people helping in that culture? And you might recognize that a training program that would work fine in one part of the United States might not work fine in another part. And certainly wouldn't work in Honduras, and may be very different than what would happen in Queensland, and that again may be different than what would happen in India. So I think we need to recognize that we need a little bit aware of what's going on. If you can figure out how to spell a man's name, I think Tan's book will help you, the Stuckey and Bear book will help you. Those are, because they at least give you some principles of the things you ought to be considering. The Tan book, incidentally, is more technical than the Stuckey and Bear book.
Well, we'll try to get hold of some of those for here this afternoon.
And I think if some of those can be available, that can be helpful. Otherwise, we can work on some ways to get them. I have a lot of questions, and I want to make sure we get these questions dealt with while we're here. But I also want to be sensitive to the time and sensitive if anybody has a question that's really pressing coming out of this morning. Otherwise, I would think, Peter, take one or two like this, and then I think we maybe go to these questions that people handed
just
in.
Just a short one. You mentioned Paul Tournier.
Yes.
Two things. I know you highly respect him, and others do too. But you also talk about, I guess, modern, up-to-date things. How do you feel people have got his books, the value of them still today, still quite relevant for present-day counseling?
Well, he's relevant? Okay. Mm-hmm. Paul Tournier, thank you. That's a good question. Paul Tournier, he died 2 or 3 years ago, so, of course, he's not, and he stopped writing several years before that. He was in his 90s when he died, and I think that towards the end he wasn't writing as much as he did before. Tournier is still helpful. Tournier is a man whose books are filled with insights, but Tournier's books are very difficult to read because he rambles all over the place, and that's very hard for me. He'll say, I want to give you 3 points on something, and then he gives, and he said, the first is this, and then you can never find the second and third because he kind of forgot about that. His writing style, he told me, was such that he said, that's all right. I had a friend who talked to him one day, and he said, look, on this page of the book you say this, and 10 pages over you contradict yourself. And he said, oh yeah, that's probably true, but I was talking about a different topic 10 pages over. See, that kind of thing drives an academic person crazy, and drives most of the rest of us. It's very difficult to handle that. So I think Tournier's books, there is insight in there, but Tournier's books are not as helpful now, I think, as they were several years ago. But I look at him as a pioneer who did something in work in bringing together some theological things and some psychological things. Now, some of you will be distressed with Tournier's theology. I was. Tournier was a universalist. He believed that everybody will ultimately be saved, and that was a problem with me. But he didn't like to talk about theology. And I began to look at, well, if his theology, I can say his theology is not correct because it's not like mine. But what about this? I began to look and recognize there are people, God uses people who have different theologies. And that's a sobering thing to think about, isn't it? And it may be when we get to heaven that all of us may have some problems with our theology. I doubt that with mine, but isn't this true, though? We're in this room. We come from different backgrounds. We have different perspectives on some things, and yet God uses us, and we don't have to have a perfect theology or a perfect psychology to be used. And God used Tony, I think, in some significant ways. Okay, maybe now other people have taken over, and that's all right. I think that's probably going to be true of all of us. 100 years from now, maybe nobody will have heard of us, but other people will take over and maybe have learned from us and grown beyond where we are, and that's exciting, and that's the way the Lord works. Excellent question. But that's, I think, where we are with Tony. Now, let me hit some of these questions here. Some of you raise a question about Maslow while we're talking about individuals. Maslow is the man. Who is Maslow, and what is your opinion of his theories? It kind of comes off of this one here. Maslow was a man who was president of the American Psychological Association for some time. He was the man who he was a man who was very much interested in humanistic psychology, and he was humanistic in his orientation. But he was also very interested in religious experience and in peak experiences. And many people would say that he was a lot of the basis of humanistic psychology. He was kind of the father of this, just like Freud was the father of psychoanalysis. Maslow was the father of humanistic psychotherapy, and he was the person that had this hierarchy that you may be familiar with, the hierarchy of needs. Once you got your biological needs met, then you came into getting needs of love and that kind of thing. At the top was your need for self-actualization, and few people got there. I have found Maslow to be stimulating in several respects. One way, for example, he spent a lot of time originally writing books about abnormality and people who had problems. And he began to think, you know, we learn from those people, but maybe we ought to start looking at people who are psychologically healthy. And so he started to look for people who were psychologically healthy. He couldn't find too many, but he found some, and on the basis of that, he built his theory. That's what Nick Stanay was doing with his study of healthy families that I mentioned last night. And I think if we're going to be Christian counselors, if we're going to be training people in life counseling, let's look at different writers. But let's look at not only what causes problems and how we deal with problems, let's also look at what brings about healthy Christianity and healthy marriages and healthy relationships and healthy careers and healthy families, and stimulate that. That's two sides of the same coin, but we sometimes have a strong pathology-type model instead of a health-type model.